Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, a radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS HD1 and WETS FM 89.5 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Today is the second in our series of programs devoted to the incarceration of thousands upon thousands of our fellow citizens, people who happened to have been of Japanese descent. I'm speaking specifically with Karen Korematsu, the daughter of the very famous Fred Korematsu, who resisted the internal deportation of so many thousands of his countrymen. Last time we discussed how Pearl Harbor, the attack by Japan on the United States, how it affected families like Fred's and like Karen's. And we're going to pick up our discussion with the strange anomaly that Franklin Roosevelt, that great liberal, that icon of the Depression, the original New Dealer, that he was the president who actually ordered these incarcerations, and that created a great disconnection between FDR, between other liberals, and between Japanese Americans who were fighting for their rights. FDR, despite the actions he took in this circumstance, was by and large considered, of course, a liberal, the New Dealer, the head New Dealer, very liberal in many respects, and by and large, you know, with the usual caveats, pro-civil rights. I think especially his wife Eleanor pushed him in that direction. Though that was not his focus. He focused on the Depression first and then the war second. But he's a liberal. He's a great big liberal. And so by and large, somebody the ACLU wants to support. And so now I guess it's understandable why the National ACLU might not want to go in direct confrontation with the president in a time of war. Even though it's difficult to understand in another respect, it's understandable politically.
And that was the atmosphere of the time as well.
Yeah.
You know, people didn't want to go against the president.
So Bessig is, what was his name again? First name was?
Ernest.
Ernest Bessig is not only, I'm sure, taking flack from a lot of people, but he's taking flack from the National ACLU itself as he pursues this case through the court system.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And he also recruits Wayne Collins from the Bay Area, who actually took my father's case to the Supreme Court. But it wasn't because of the appeal system. It wasn't heard until December of 1944.
Okay.
And by that time, my father was already out of the camp, and I think he might have been in Detroit by that time. And
so he's making an argument pursuant to the Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment in Section 1, and he's saying pretty clearly now he's not being treated equally compared to, well, I'm sure he's got lots of constitutional claims, due process, et cetera, but the one that the court ultimately focuses on is his Equal Protection Clause. He and other Japanese Americans are not being treated like other Americans.
That's correct.
What does the court do?
Well, the court rules against him.
Wow.
However, it is important to point out that it was a 6-3 decision.
Mm-hmm.
There were three dissenting opinions, which probably are the most studied and recognized, really, especially in constitutional law today. I mean, Justice Jackson has this famous quote that says, you know, this case, referring to my father's, lies around like a loaded weapon, ready to be picked up and used by anyone who deems it appropriate.
Jackson had a way with words.
Yes, he did.
My goodness. And so the Supreme Court, let me just talk a little bit about constitutional law. Korematsu, this particular case, is often considered right up there with Plessy versus Ferguson and, of course, with the Dred Scott case of the 19th century as one of the worst two or three cases in the history of the U.S. Supreme Court. Because, of course, as you say, your father was denied his equal protection rights, as were all Japanese Americans, all people of Japanese descent who were incarcerated. But the strange irony is that in that very same case, the court adopted a standard of review of these cases that at least sounds very, very strict. In fact, they call it strict scrutiny. They say if the government's going to do this, if the government's going to discriminate against somebody on the basis, in this case, of nationality or race, closely related concepts, which was pretty clearly going on here, then it's going to have to justify itself with two things. First of all, it's going to have to show a compelling reason for this discrimination. And secondly, it's going to have to demonstrate that, and only if it demonstrates that compelling reason, that the means it chooses to achieve that compelling objective are the least restrictive means. It's doing it in a way that's the least restrictive of people's rights. And so that strict scrutiny standard, it stands today and is applied today very strictly whenever cases of racial discrimination come before the court. But the great irony, constitutionally speaking, is that that very protective standard was established for racial and national discrimination in the Korematsu case, and then the court turned right around and and didn't apply it to your father.
Yes.
And that always really strikes me. In fact, let's just go through the analysis. It's easy to meet the first part of it. It's easy to say that the United States had a compelling reason to protect itself. It had just been attacked, the national security, it's always a compelling reason. That's the easy part of the test. But even if you grant that we were at war, that we'd been attacked, that we were concerned about sabotage, that we were concerned about an invasion of the West Coast, concerned about all those things, even if you grant that first prong of the test, is the least restrictive way to deal with it to gather up tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people and put them in concentration camps? That's the part of the test where people to this day, they still can't understand how the court could have ever thought that that part of the test was satisfied, especially given the contrast with how we treated German Americans and Italian Americans. We had the same concerns on the East Coast, and yet we didn't do that on the East Coast. And so it's that second part of the test, the least restrictive means prong of the test, that constitutional scholars still scratch their heads over and lament to this day.
Yes, and that's why my father's Supreme Court case is still studied so widely today, because of the lessons, and also the relevancy of some of our issues that we're still discussing today.
Absolutely, but I teach it every spring. It's a focal point of my equal protection segment in my spring semester constitutional law class. But let's get back and finish the narrative. Your father, I think we left him in Detroit. He'd met your mother. Is that where you were born?
No. Actually, I was born back in the Bay Area. They left there in 1949, and because my grandmother wasn't well, my grandparents had come back and returned to their home, or what was left of it, after the war.
No. Okay. So during the war, if you left the camp, you could only go east.
Yes.
But after the war, you could go back home.
Yes.
And
yes.
Certainly people who had left and gone east during the war is over, and now they can go back west. So that explains how your father and mother could come back to California.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So they're back in California.
And my father, as we said, his conviction was, still on the records, and had a sentence of probation for about 7 years. So he, he still had a federal prison record. But coming back to the Bay Area, he did experience employment problems and even housing issues. There were certain areas of the Bay Area where real estate agents wouldn't even sell to anyone of Japanese ancestry, or even Chinese for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And then I grew up. My brother, I have a younger brother, so he was born 4 years younger. And we went to schools in the East Bay, which was mostly kind of Caucasian kids. And so
Did you know about this growing up?
No, I learned about my father's Supreme Court case in high school. I was a junior in high school, and in my social studies class, the teacher had assigned different paperback books for each student to read and then get up and give an oral book report, and none of us knew what each other had. And my friend Maya, who is Sansei Japanese American, as I, was given this paperback book to report on, called Concentration Camps USA. And she gets up in front of the class one day and then starts to talk about the Japanese American internment. And I'm thinking to myself, well, that's interesting. I've never heard anybody talk about that before. What's that about? And then she goes on to say, well, there was this one person that refused the military orders, and his case ended up to go all the way to the Supreme Court. And it's a famous case called Korematsu versus the United States. Well, I'm thinking to myself, that's my name. And all of a sudden,
find out about this.
Yes, and I have 35 pairs of eyes turning around and looking at me. And I went to a high school of about 2,500, and there were probably only about six, Asian American kids in the school. And the only thing that I know is that my name, Korematsu, is a very unusual Japanese name. And this is all racing through my head, and I'm thinking, oh, well, this is some black sheep of the family. This has got, maybe it's my my father's oldest brother who didn't end up to be the shining light after all. Mm-hmm. Or I knew that my grandfather had a brother that had been in the Bay Area before the war, but somehow kind of disappeared, and I never knew anything about him. So it had to be maybe one of those two. And then I get to the end of the class, and I ask my friend Maya, well, what's this about? And she says, well, this is about your father. And I said, no.
Oh, my goodness.
This can't be about my father. Someone would have told me. So I run home and confront my mother, and yes, this is about your father, and you'll have to talk to him, when he gets home, is her answer. And I said, well, why didn't anybody tell me? Well, we were going to tell you when you got older. Well, I am older. And, when you're about ready to go to college, well, I'm about ready to go to college. So we were just kind of caught up in our everyday lives. And
so this is 20 years after it happened. This is in the early 60s now, right?
Yes. This is like 1966.
So you've grown up. It's been more than 20 years since all this happened, and no one in your family had ever mentioned this to you.
No. But I did learn later that there was a code of silence amongst the Japanese American community that had been incarcerated. They didn't want to talk about their experience. They just wanted to get on with their lives and raise their families and work hard, and that was their way of demonstrating that they were good Americans. So it wasn't unusual for my family not to talk about this.
Was the additional factor, though, that your dad had resisted?
Yes.
Was there still that tension?
Yes, and I think he was afraid of what his children were going to think of him. But certainly I didn't think of anything less of him. And so he worked long hours. He, had, as I said, employment problems. And so by the time he got home, several hours later, and I asked him, and he basically said to me that what he decided to do was right, and he felt like the government was wrong. And it was that clear and simple to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I could just see the pain in his eyes, and I just couldn't talk about it anymore.
Sounds like it's still emotional for you.
Yes.
Yeah, I can imagine. Was this a lengthy conversation? Did you go into detail, or did he just basically tell you that, and that was the end of it?
No, it wasn't lengthy. As I said, just because I was very close to my father, and I could feel his pain. That I asked him, like, a question, can you vote? Yes, he could vote. And I basically said, well, what does this mean? And he says, well, you're safe. Even though my father never felt like his children were safe. Just because of what happened to the Japanese American people, he felt like it could happen again.
Mm.
What if Japan did something crazy? What would happen to his children? and he always worried about that. The irony to the story, though, is, as I said, my brother Ken, who is 4 years younger, learned about my father's Supreme Court case the same way in high school.
Oh, you mean you didn't talk to him about it?
No.
Yeah, so you adopted the code of silence, too.
Yeah, I guess, if you will. But then also, if you have siblings, you understand that there's a big gap of 4 years there. Mm-hmm. And it's like a whole generation, and especially since I'm the girl and he's the boy, his attitude was, well, you're not my mother, don't tell me what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So he was always out playing sports and doing his own thing. So he didn't want to necessarily listen to his big sister. And I didn't really know how to really internalize all of that. The only thing that I experienced and saw was when my father, a few years afterwards, had tried to apply for a real estate license with the state of California. He wanted to get into some other work, and he took the course in a junior college and passed it with flying colors. And then, and filled out the application. And then once he saw the application, it says, do you have a prison record? And once that's determined, then he was denied his real estate license.
So his prison record was following him around?
Yes.
My goodness. And this is 20, 25 years later?
Yes.
All right. Well, did he... Well, I know the answer to this question, but for the benefit of our listeners, what happened next?
Well, he demonstrated his life by working in the community and being in the Lions Club and helping Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and going to church and so that's how he carried on with his life and taught my brother and I those lessons.
Mm-hmm.
So fast forward, in 1982, he receives first this letter from Professor Peter Irons, saying that he was doing some research to write a book, and he had found some material, some evidence that he wanted to share with my father. Well, my father never wanted to talk about his case. I mean, obviously, he didn't talk to me much about it, but he even, always growing up, we got some phone calls later on after I was in high school to people that wanted to interview him and ask him questions, and one time he did speak at the University of California, and that was such a terrible experience for him because the students were, why didn't you speak up? Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? And he just felt very badly.
Mm-hmm.
But Peter Irons was persistent and said, he wanted to come see my father. He had all these papers, and actually it turned out to be evidence. And so when Peter Irons showed my father this evidence, it proved that there was no military necessity for the Japanese and Japanese Americans to be forced to be moved from their homes. Peter, along with a researcher in Aiko Herzog Yoshinaga, had found evidence in the files in Washington, D.C. Actually, it was in Immigration and Naturalization where he found this box, which is the irony of it. But this box, when he opened it up, this dusty box, he could tell no one had even looked at it for almost 40 years. It opened it up, and on the top was the file, was this paper. It's like it had been left there, like someone purposely had left it there for someone to find, not at the bottom, but at the top.
Mm-hmm.
That showed, that this evidence that at the time of my father's Supreme Court case in 1944, the Department of Justice had lied, altered, and destroyed evidence before the Supreme Court. The Department of Justice had even reports like the Ringel Report, which said that there was no evidence of Japanese espionage. Even J. Edgar Hoover had written a letter to the Department of Justice saying that there was no reason for the Japanese and Japanese Americans to be incarcerated in mass.
And the Justice Department had shared none of this with the courts?
That's correct.
It's your weekly Constitutional. We're speaking with Karen Korematsu about her family's experiences, not just with the Japanese incarcerations of the 1940s, but also with the aftermath and the continuing legal battle that her father waged. Stay tuned.
So now they're in a town with soldiers surrounding them. Every day, every night, look down at them. From watchtowers up on the wall, Ken couldn't really hate them at all. They were just doing the job, and he wasn't gonna make any problems. He had a little garden, vegetables and fruits that he gave to the troops in a basket his wife made. But in the back of his mind, he wanted his family's life saved. Prisoners of war in their own damn country, what for? And time passed in the prison town. He wondered if he'd live it down, if and when they were free. The only...
Once again, it's time for our constitutional quiz, and here with us in spirit, and not if not in actual physical person, is our soon-to-be quiz mom, Kelly Carmichael. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, how are you?
Doing extremely well. Do you have a good question for us this week?
I do indeed.
All right.
All right, the question. United States citizens may work to change government policy by doing all of the following, except...
Oh, okay. So U.S. citizens can do all of it. Okay. Except what?
Except A, making public speeches. B, writing letters of protest. C, petitioning legislators. D, refusing to pay taxes. Or E, joining an organization.
But wait a second. You slipped in an extra answer choice there.
I did. We have an E today.
We have an E today. Okay. And we're looking for the one of those five question answers that U.S. citizens cannot do in order to influence public policy. So what were they again?
The answer choices were A, making public speeches. B, writing letters of protest. C, petitioning legislators. D, refusing to pay taxes, or E, joining an organization.
All right, Kelly, thank you. Let's see what our contestant has to say. On the line is Gary. Gary, where are you from?
I'm from Prestonsburg, Kentucky.
Prestonsburg, Kentucky. I'm going to guess that that's named after somebody named Preston.
I would imagine.
But you don't know which Preston it's named at?
No, I just recently moved there a couple years ago, so I'm... not fully acclimated, I guess.
Okay, well, you've already missed one question then, so it's not looking good for you on this quiz. I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. Do you have
time for redemption?
Well, we'll see. Do you have? Let's go through the answer choices Kelly just gave us again, one by one. You tell me which one you think it might be.
Okay.
How about A? Was it making public speeches? Is that something American citizens are not allowed to do to influence public policy?
I'm pretty sure that's protected by the First Amendment for the most part.
Okay, that sounds reasonable. What about B? Are American citizens prohibited from writing letters of protest?
I think that's also a form of free speech, so I don't think that's the answer.
Yeah, that pesky free speech thing. Okay, how about C? Are citizens prohibited from petitioning their legislators?
I'm pretty sure that you're allowed to write your congressman and or senator or anything like that, so... don't think that's the answer yet either.
All right. What about D, refusing to pay taxes?
Nah, that's the one I think it is.
Yeah, we have to pay taxes?
Well, I've always heard that old saying, there's only two things for sure in life, that's death and taxes.
Benjamin Franklin again. He strikes again. Well, before we settle on that, let's make sure it's not E. What about joining an organization? Are Americans prohibited from joining an organization to influence policy?
I think they can do that for the most part, at least, so I don't think that's the answer either. I'm going to stick with D.
D, refusing to pay taxes. Well, let's see what Kelly has to say. So, Kelly, what's the answer to this question about what citizens may not do?
Citizens may not refuse to pay taxes.
Okay. That's what Gary said, and... sadly, I think he's right. In fact, it's kind of funny that you certainly can, of course, challenge taxes. But the general rule is you got to pay them up front, and then you can challenge them after the fact. And you certainly can't refuse to pay taxes because you don't like where the money is going. People have tried that periodically throughout history. People who don't, you know, for example, they're against a war, so they say, I'm not going to pay that part of it, that my taxes that go to the Defense Department, or I don't like this, or I don't like that. And those are inevitably turned back, such challenges. And Gary, you already figured out that the other ones answer choices A, B, C, and E were all, in fact, protected, and they were protected by the same provision. What was that provision again?
The First Amendment.
That's right. This is really a First Amendment question in disguise. All those things. Joining an organization is the right of assembly. Petitioning your legislators is the right of petition. And writing letters and making speeches are very much free speech. So this was a First Amendment question. And essentially what you did is spot the one thing that's not protected by the First Amendment. It would be kind of nice if the First Amendment said that the government couldn't be But I'm afraid that that's simply not the case. But in any event, you won. You get a T-shirt, so thanks very much for playing.
All right, well, thank you.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Now let's continue our discussion with Karen Korematsu about her father's legal battle against the incarceration of Japanese Americans.
There is a procedure, a very unknown procedure, called Petition Writ of Error Quorum Nobis.
Mm-hmm.
That actually Peter himself had experienced. And on that technicality, they were able to reopen my father's Supreme Court case along with two others, Gordon Hirabayashi and Minya Sui.
Mm-hmm.
Theirs had to do with more of the curfew issue of the time of the incarceration.
Wow. And so Peter Irons, who incidentally has been on a couple of our episodes, and he's a wonderful fellow and tells a great story. I'll have to see if we can come on and talk to us about this as well. So he essentially came in and said, look, here's the evidence. You should never have been convicted, and I think I can get you pardoned?
Yes. Well, that, you know, my father, you know, said to Peter, you know, are you an attorney? And Peter said yes, and said, well, but you know, would he help him? And he said yes. And so then Peter recruited a group of Japanese-American attorneys, most of them here in the Bay Area, some Caucasians as well, to help reopen my father's case. I didn't know it until that time, though. My father had always been looking for someone to help him. He had discussed this with my mother, but of course he never did with his children. But he just didn't know how to do that. He thought attorneys were expensive and he didn't know any. But he never gave up hope, and I think that's one of his, you know, powerful lessons of his story.
What happened? I mean, he and Peter Irons finally found each other, and they pushed forward with this team of lawyers. What happened?
Well, they actually decided they had to even work in secret and raise money in secret, this legal team, because the evidence that they found, you know, they didn't want the government to know exactly what they had. And so on November 10th, 1983, in the U.S. Federal Court of Northern California here in San Francisco, my father's case was presented to Judge Marilyn Hall Patel. Now, I also have to say the government tried to stall several times and get the case kind of you know, thrown out, but you know, the legal team was very persistent and had great evidence, and they also worked, you know, for your law students, they also worked pro bono. This team dedicated themselves day, night, weekends. I mean, they had other jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a great risk as well, because if they had lost this case, it's like they would have lost Korematsu versus the United States all over again.
Yeah, you know, you've mentioned Mr. Bessig, you've mentioned Wayne Collins, you've mentioned this team of lawyers, you've mentioned Peter Irons, and I'm glad you have, and I appreciate your commenting that these lawyers were doing this not only pro bono, not only for free, but at great professional risk. And, you know, so often we hear people slam the legal profession, and I have to admit, you know, as a lawyer, as a law professor, I get a little tired of hearing about it.
Yeah.
So lawyers do. Now, lawyers aren't perfect. Lawyers, I'm not defending all lawyers. You can always find a bad apple. There's no question. But lawyers, when they are consistent with the noblest parts of the profession, will do noble things. And it sounds to me like there's more than one noble lawyer in this case.
Oh, yes. And The bonus is that this legal team of 10 has ended up to be an extended part of the Korematsu family. So even today, we all are supportive of each other. In fact, they're the ones that My father's case was overturned that day of November 10th, 1983. And so his conviction was thrown out, even though his record still stands on the Supreme Court. You know, the Supreme Court, and you can probably explain more about this than I as a layperson, can only reverse itself, from my understanding.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about this is that your father, at this point now, his conviction's thrown out, so he no longer has a prison record. So that's great. He can get his real estate license. He can do whatever he wants to do. It's not going to follow him around anymore. And I'm guessing then that the government did not appeal that.
Correct.
And so that's the end of that case. That case is not going to go to the Supreme Court. And so the original Korematsu case back in 1944 is, to this day, still good law.
Correct.
And that's the remarkable thing. There have been lots of various people, Supreme Court justices, commentators, who have said that, you know, Korematsu has been overruled by time and by changing society and by subsequent precedents. And what they mean by that is that they hope, at least, that such a case would not be decided the same way today. Maybe another reason that they haven't gone back and overruled it is because it did announce that extremely important strict scrutiny rule for equal protection claims alleging racial or national origin discrimination. But for whatever reason, your dad's original case is still good law. And that's just one of those constitutional anomalies that's out there. You're right. The only court in the land that can actually go back and say Korematsu's overruled is the Supreme Court itself, and it's very unlikely they'll ever have occasion to do that.
Yes, but it has been discredited.
Oh, completely. I mean, like I said, it's right up there with Dred Scott. That's what it's one of the most infamous cases in U.S. Supreme Court history.
However, the government did try to cite it as a reason after 9/11. To round up anyone of Arab and Muslim American and put them in American concentration camps.
Oh boy, now you're talking. Now you're bringing it up to the current day. Now you're bringing it up, and here's the constitutional relevance in the current day: is that, you know, whenever there's a national emergency, whenever the country is under attack, we have the same tendency to paint with a very broad brush and to look at somebody who we can demonize as the other. And somehow justify taking whole groups of people, maybe even including little children and old folks, and treating them in ways that no one should be treated. And that's the terrifying thing just about human nature.
Yes.
And that's why it's so important that we talk about your father's case and we talk about what a bad decision it was in so many respects. But let's go back to the good Korematsu case. Let's go back to the fact that he was eventually, his conviction was vacated. Other good things happened after that, didn't they?
Well, yes, and my father recognized that in order for something like this not to happen again, that education was important. And so he, with the encouragement of his legal team, kind of helped him get his voice, because my father was a very shy and humble person. He was very quiet. He was the type of person that believed everybody was as honest as he was. I mean, he lived by his principles. And, you know, he, in the beginning, didn't really want to talk about his case. But as I said, he found his voice and ended up crisscrossing the United States and then also was part of the National Coalition for Redress and Reparations group that went to Washington, D.C. to help lobby for the Civil Liberties Act that eventually was signed by President Reagan in 1988, which gave the official apology to anyone of Japanese ancestry that had been incarcerated. Also, they had been given, you had to be alive to receive $20,000 as compensation, but that wasn't the point. I mean, you know, you have to almost, you know, throw money at the government to get their attention.
Mm-hmm.
But what was most important to everyone of Japanese ancestry was the apology, because they had been carrying around this stigma, this burden had been weighed on their shoulders all those years. And and my father was, you know, his case, 1983, was, you know, set the precedent for the redress and reparations apology.
Wow. And was there a ceremony or anything at the time?
There was at the White House, yes. My father wasn't there, but there was the signing of the bill by President Reagan and many of the...
Your father wasn't there? What's the story there?
Well, I'm not sure why he wasn't there, but he wasn't there.
Oh, okay, okay.
For one reason or another. But, you know, of course, members of Congress were there of Japanese ancestry, and my because my father always, you know, spoke so highly of them, and they're the ones that gave their testimonials on the floors of the various houses and told them, you know, the other Congress people of their experience of how they had to grow up in camp, because, I mean, they were, you know, a lot
in,
of
in fact,
younger.
you're just reminding me, Senator Inouye, right?
Yes.
He's
yes.
from Hawaii, and in fact, I think he's served close to 50 years now in the Senate. And if I recall correctly, didn't he serve in World War II, and didn't he lose part of his arm or something?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
Right.
And
he was from Hawaii, so his family...
He was from Hawaii.
So his family didn't get incarcerated, but he was also, I'm sure, suffered discrimination as a Japanese-American during
absolutely.
That time.
Yes, he's one of our senior senators now.
Yes, of course. All right, but then something else happened.
Well, yes. Well, with my father's continuous work to educate... he received various awards, and I guess the ultimate would be the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which he received from President Clinton in January of 1998.
And that is the highest civilian award that an American can get. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where Karen Korematsu is telling me all about how her father was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. After the break, we'll talk a little bit about what's happening this week at Montpelier, and then we'll come back and finish our discussion with Karen Korematsu. Stick around.
Supposedly, some men went out for the army, signed on, and ended up flying to Japan with a bomb. That 15-kiloton blast put an end to the war pretty fast. Two cities were blown to bits. The end of the war came quick, and Ken got out. Big hopes of a normal life with his kids and his wife, but then they got back to their home, and they saw made him feel so alone. These people had trashed every room, smashed in the windows and bashed in the doors, written on the walls and the floor, Japs not welcome anymore.
And now let's speak to a couple from Northern Virginia on a recent visit to Montpelier.
My name's Randy Reese. This is my wife, Jane.
Hello, Jane.
Hi, good to meet you.
We're from Northern Virginia, Woodbridge, Prince William County, and we were just down to Charlottesville to visit our daughter, and we're on our way home.
Oh, so this is right along the way, isn't it?
Yeah,
we figured we'd try a different route. Normally, we would go up Route 29, but...
That's boring.
Yes, it is boring. This is very lovely.
This is a nice way to go.
This is very nice.
And enjoying the visit here because it is the way it was in the day of James Madison.
Right.
I like that. Other places, there's been so much development around the area that it's not quite as scenic as this.
You know, they actually have a name for that. They call it the View Shed.
The
View Shed is pristine here. It really does look very much like it did in the day.
Yes. Right, unlike Monticello, which really is not like it was in the day as far as the view is concerned. Pretty much, but not totally.
Yeah.
This is really...
And the tour guide here was very well informed. Did a great job of giving us background and lots of information. It's been great.
Tremendous. Was there anything particularly striking about Montpelier that really stuck in your mind?
Just the locale and the environment, the views and so on. And the work that they're doing on the restoration is amazing.
Uh-huh. It's kind of fun to see it in process, isn't it?
It is. That one room that they had there where they showed the innards of the structure and so on was very interesting.
The room with the glass door?
The one where the beam.
The beam was, yeah.
Yeah,
and the bolts that hold the floor.
Right,
because they took out the load bearing wall below.
Right.
It's very interesting to see what they did.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Enjoy your day.
And now let's take a moment for our Madison Minute.
Montpelier was built and operated by African American slaves. In 1723, James Madison's grandfather, Ambrose Madison, bought the land that would become Montpelier, although Ambrose called it Mount Pleasant. Ambrose sent a group of slaves to build a house and develop the property as a tobacco plantation. The plantation was a success, but Ambrose did not live to see it. He moved his family to Mount Pleasant in 1732. He died that same summer at the age of 36. Three slaves were convicted of his murder. Two slaves, named Dido and Turk, were whipped and returned to work. The third slave, named Pompey, was executed. Supposedly, Dido and Turk were less involved in the murder than was Pompey, but perhaps the fact that they were owned by the Madisons and that Pompey was owned by a neighbor also had something to do with their different treatment. With the Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blalock.
And now it's time to finish our discussion with Karen Korematsu. We're at a happy, moving part of the tale, where Karen's telling us about her father's meeting with President Bill Clinton.
I'll tell you a little story to that, to tell you, to hopefully kind of give you an idea of the type of person my father was. In December of 1997, which is a month before the actual ceremony is supposed to take place, my parents receive a phone call at their home in the East Bay, and my father answers the phone, and the person on the other line says, "Mr. Korematsu," and he says, "Yes." He says, "Well, Mr. Korematsu, how are you?" "I'm all right." "Well, Mr. Korematsu, this is the White House." "Okay," says my father. "Well, Mr. Korematsu, President Clinton would like to give you the Presidential Medal of Freedom." "Okay," my father says. "Well, Mr. Korematsu, are you well?" "Yes, I'm okay." "Well, Mr. Korematsu, can you come to the White House on January 15th of next year, meaning 1998? And my father says to this aide, "Well, I don't know. You'll have to speak to my wife," and passes the phone to my mother. who gets on the phone and gives this guy the third degree? Because, you know, it's like, is this really for true? Is this candid camera, but on the phone?
Right.
You know, she's very, very suspicious. Because you would think that if you're going to receive the Presidential Medal of Freedom, you might get an official letter from the White House to say, you know, "Mr. Korematsu, you know, congratulations, da-da-da-da." No. The White House doesn't work that way. And so after a period of conversation, the White House says to my mother, "Well, we'll call you back with some details." So, of course, you know, they're thinking, well, they're going to tell my parents, you know, when they really need to be there and what time and, you know, what, you know, when they're going to send the airline ticket and what hotel that they'll be staying at, that you would think that the White House would be making those arrangements. And so the White House calls back and asks the question, "Well, have you, you know, to my father, have you made your arrangements, you know, to fly to Washington, D.C.?" And actually, my mother is the one that's talking on the phone, and she says, "Well, aren't you going to be sending us the airline tickets, or at least an airline ticket for my husband?" And the White House says, "Well, no, you have to pay for your own expenses."
Mm.
So here's the lesson. If you want to receive the Presidential Medal of Freedom, you have to pay for your own expenses to get to the White House in order to receive it.
That is a revelation to me, and and that's that and it's of course remarkable in many respects. I still have to chuckle though the way your dad handed the phone to your mom. That's the way things work in my house as well.
So once my mother explains this to my father, my father's reaction is, "Well, you know, in that case, because, you know, my father is retired, I mean, and so to speak, and, you know, their income is not great. He didn't ever get a pension. They don't have a lot of money to be kind of flying, you know, everywhere. I mean, when he's been invited to travel, everyone else has paid for his expenses and my mother's." And so my father says, "Well, just then tell President Clinton to send the medal to me in the mail." That's how practical my father was.
Oh, my goodness. Good heavens. And so what was their reaction at that point?
Well, of course, everybody is, including, you know, my brother and I and my husband, going, "Oh, no, we'll have to find a way, you know. This is really important." And I don't think my father kind of really recognized the significance of all of this. And so fortunately, through the Civil Liberties Public Education Fund, they were able to pay for my father's ticket, and then the other was raised by the Japanese American Citizens League, and so they got my parents there. My brother and I and my husband were there, for this ceremony, because there were also 14 other recipients that represented our different communities of culture in the United States. So it was a very special
ceremony. Well, I'm glad that at least it didn't cost your parents anything when your dad got the Presidential Medal of Freedom. That would have been too bad.
Yes.
So did anything memorable about the ceremony or about that time?
Well, yes. I mean, actually, you know, as I said, there were 15 recipients. And it was a big formal ceremony. I mean, they had the military band playing in the foyer, and then you had a military attaché who escorted each recipient into the East Room of the White House where the ceremony was. And there were three rows, at least along the whole entire length of the East Room, of press from all over the world. Actually, which I was, you know, so surprised to see. And it was the only time that the entire press corps stopped and clapped for my father after President Clinton read his citation.
Wow.
So they did not do that for any other recipient.
Did the president say anything particularly memorable to your dad or to you?
Oh, well, yes, because it was arranged as such that each family was divided up into three rooms of the White House: the Red Room, the Blue Room, and the Green Room. And so then before the ceremony, President and Mrs. Clinton went around, and we met with them for a few minutes and chatted and took pictures. And you know, President Clinton said, "Oh, I've told my father that he had taught about my father's, you know, Supreme Court case at law school." And
that's right. Clinton was a law professor at the University of Arkansas. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And so he certainly knew all about my father, and Mrs. Clinton was equally, so wonderful to meet. I mean, obviously we recognize her work today, but which comes really to me by no surprise after meeting her for the first time.
Wow.
It was really memorable. But also I remember my father afterwards telling me that after everyone had met with the president, then the recipients were escorted to one room, and then they all kind of met each other. So there was 15 in total, which was wonderful, because there was Justin Dart was there, who was responsible for our American Disabilities Act. Chief Justice Wilma Mankiller, who was our first woman American Indian chief, who I also got to meet, you know, after the ceremony. That was exciting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had David Rockefeller and Brooke Astor. I mean, it was quite a range of people. And so my father goes up to David Rockefeller, and, you know, who everyone knows, and, you know, tries to introduce himself, and Mr. Rockefeller says, "Oh, Fred, we know all about you, and we think what you did and stood up against the government is wonderful."
Wow. That is just remarkable. Just remarkable. And you were there for all of this.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'll never forget that.
No, I bet you won't. Well, that certainly seems to be a complete reversal of his experiences back in the early 1940s. He's a fellow who's really come full circle and is one of the people that we commonly call a constitutional hero, a person who stands up for the rest of us, not just for himself, but for his community and for all of us in this country. And so I'm so glad to see that he lived long enough to be vindicated and to witness his own vindication in that way.
Yes, and I think that is one of the lessons of his story is he stood up for what is right. And, you know, he passed away 7 years ago in 2005, and you never know what's going to happen to someone's legacy. I mean, my father continually spoke, and later I traveled with him and my mother as well, because in their advanced years couldn't travel on their own, so I was able to hear and witness the reactions of people when he did tell their story, and that of the Japanese-American incarceration. And, you know, you just don't know what's going to happen to someone's legacy when they pass away. I mean, we, you know, certainly in the law books, we knew that would probably carry on. But since his passing, there's been three public schools named after him here in California as well. And then in 2009, we established the Fred T. Korematsu Center for Law and Equality at Seattle University School of Law. And that carries on my father's work in academia and amicus briefs. And then also we now have a professor of ship named after my father at the University of Hawaii School of Law.
Wow.
And that belongs to Eric Yamamoto, who was actually on my father's legal team, but he's also considered a civil rights scholar.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2009, I co-founded the Fred Korematsu Institute to carry on my father's legacy of civil rights education, not knowing that in 2010 a legislative bill was introduced by California Assembly Member Warren Furutani and Assembly Member Marty Block to establish Fred Korematsu Day of Civil Liberties and the Constitution for the state of California on my father's birthday of January 30th. Coming up next year.
That's coming up. That's right.
Yes, yes. And this is in perpetuity. Now, unfortunately, it's not a legal holiday. No one gets it off. You know, California has its financial issues, as other states do. But the purpose really is education. And so through the Korematsu Institute, as it's written into the bill, that we focus on education, especially from kindergarten through 12th grade. And so through the Institute, we've developed a teaching curriculum that actually, for teachers who are listening to this, can go to the website and order teachers' kits for free. The website is www.korematsuinstitute.org.
And can you spell that for us?
Yes, yeah, so it's Korematsu Institute.org.
Okay, and the Korematsu Institute's all one word?
Yes, all one word.
Okay, and they can get these teaching materials. Yeah, I think I'm going to be getting some of those soon, actually.
Oh, good.
I've asked for some of them, yeah.
We developed a teacher's guide and have lessons plans in there and additional information also, not just about my father, but people like the No-No Boys, showing the questionnaire, maps of the internment camps, also about the Japanese-American internment, you know, stories as well. And then we have supplemental materials. We have my mother gave my brother the charge of making a documentary about my father kind of in the early 1990s. You know, she said my brother was in advertising at the time and said, well, everybody else is making a documentary about their fathers. Why don't you? And, of course, that sounds a little simpler than the actual outcome. But it took over 11 years for my brother to have this documentary made because funders didn't find my brother in a director's role as being objective enough to tell a documentary about my father. So he brought in a friend, a documentary director, and a friend, Eric Paul Fournier, who finished the film. And in 2001, it was introduced. In 2002, it received two Emmys for Best Director and Best Editing. And then in a year ago, through the Institute, we got a grant to cut down the original documentary, which is still available, reduce it to 24 minutes so that teachers can show the film in their classrooms and then also have time for discussion following. So, and then a lot of times I travel with the film and speak and give workshops and talk to students about my father's story and that of the Japanese-American incarceration and how it relates to our issues today. You know, we're still talking about basically these same issues 70 years later. They just have different names. We talked about immigration of alien and non-alien, and now it's referred to as documented and undocumented. And in 1942, it was, you know, deemed military necessity. Well, now we have national security. Mm-hmm. And in 42, it was, you know, racial prejudice, and now we have racial profiling. So my father's, you know, story is so really relevant you know, to our issues that we're still discussing.
Some issues never go away. They never go away, Karen. And I was out at the Korematsu Institute you know, when we missed each other, and I had the pleasure of meeting Ling and a number of other people out there and speaking to them. And I saw some of these materials. I saw the maps. I was stunned by how many of these camps there were and how widespread they were across the United States. I think there was even one here in Tennessee. So it's just absolutely remarkable to me. So you're carrying on your father's work. You're fighting the good fight, and we certainly appreciate your sharing his story with you. Just one last question before we go.
Okay.
Back in 1966, when you first heard your high school presentation and found out that this was your father who had done these remarkable things, did you ever think, have any idea that you'd be doing what you're doing now?
No, absolutely not. And even after my father's case was overturned in 1983, I certainly didn't think I would be the one that would be carrying on his legacy. His legal team did a great job of traveling with my father, and also they still speak today. But my formal training, I was a hotel designer and had my own hospitality design firm. So I did not know that I'd be picking up this mantle. But my father, before he passed away, gave me that charge to say that, you know, he was getting to the point where he didn't feel like he could do this. And this was only about five months before he passed away. And that now it was up to me to carry on.
Well, thank you for doing so, and thank you for speaking to us, Karen Korematsu. We'll all be celebrating Fred T. Korematsu Day out here on January the 30th, and we thank you very much for your time.
Well, and thank you, and also one of my goals I must mention is to establish Fred Korematsu Days in other states. And so as I go around, I'm also encouraging states to create that day. So eventually it'll become a national day of recognition because, you know, this is an American story. And these types of stories are the ones that should inspire our children. And I hope that the outcome will be that someday nationally we'll have a Fred Korematsu Day.
Well, Karen, when you come out to Virginia, you let us know, and we'll set you up, and you can come out and stay at Montpelier for a couple of days, and you can perhaps give some presentations at the Center for the Constitution, and I'm sure they'd be more than happy to have you come and tell your story.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Karen. And that's our show, or I should say it's almost our show. I have a sad update to share with you. Since this interview was recorded, Senator Daniel Inouye of Hawaii, whom we discussed in the show, passed away on December 17th, 2012. He was the longest-serving current United States senator and the second longest-serving senator in United States history. He was a remarkable man. After the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, young Daniel Inouye tried to enlist in the U.S. military, but he was refused at first because Japanese Americans were classified as enemy aliens. But he and other Japanese Americans petitioned the president to let them fight for their country. In 1943, Daniel Inouye joined a Japanese American unit sent to Europe and saw heavy combat. In Italy, he personally stormed three German machine gun nests, taking them out but losing his right arm in the process. Half a century later, Inouye and 22 other Asian American World War II veterans finally received the Medal of Honor for bravery in the battlefield. So we salute Senator Daniel Inouye. Rest in peace. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Larry Mayer. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.